I'm Jay Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our writers, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are talking about Pottymouth dog movie Strays with the director Josh Greenbaum, and we're rating that, plus new superhero actioner Blue Beetle, and French romance Lie With Me. But before we get onto those, Jack, what else have you been watching? What have you been feasting your eyes on?
My most recent watch has been They Clone Tyrone on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the film with John Boyega and Teyonna Parris, who's obviously on the cover of Total Film as well, for the Marvels, and Jamie Foxx as well. I mean, I thought it was a really creative, interesting film. One of Netflix's better ones as well. I mean, I haven't seen the new Gal Gadot movie, Heart of Stone, but I've heard mixed things from people. But I don't know, maybe it's amazing. I need to give it a watch because I know part of it's set in Lisbon, and I've just got back from Lisbon, so that would be
it is. There is a pretty good car chase through the sort of cobbled streets of Lisbon, which involves sort of reversing a clapped out old van down the streets whilst trams and things whiz past. So that's pretty good. And I think that's the thing about Hearthstone. When it's doing its thing and it's doing action, it's doing it very well. Netflix do this very well, you know, Six Underground and The Grey Man. That's not lacking. What's sort of lacking is the chatting in between that doesn't quite work. I really like Gal Gadot and I have a lot of goodwill towards her. I think probably because she just so embodies Wonder Woman for me. But yeah, I'm not sure that this, I mean, she's really competent at the action, but I'm not sure that this is her fit in terms of the drama. I don't know. They definitely set it up as a sequel. I wonder if they will make one.
I do wonder. I mean, Netflix have been trying to start a big franchise for quite a long time. I mean, they've had The Old Guard and Extraction, all these movies that are kind of setting up things for the future. So I'll definitely give it a watch, even if it's just to reminisce about my holiday. I mean, other than that, my watching this week has been more old school. I've been making my way through a load of iPlayer films because they have a collection of classics. And this week, my watch was Blackbeard the Pirate, which has Robert Newton as Blackbeard. Now, I didn't really realize like how influential he was on pirates everywhere, because he was Long John Silver in the 1950s Treasure Island, all these things. And so he's technically or unofficially the patron saint of International Talk Like a Pirate Day, because the kind of like arm hearties West Country-ish accent all starts from him doing that on film, and it kind of just got really famous from there. So so there you go.
I was like Steve the Pirate from Dodgeball.
Yes.
Gar, Steve. Well, that's quite a good one to do. I have revisited a couple of classics, Some Like It Hot and Roman Holiday, just because I thought I've not seen them for a while and I still love them as much as ever. Yeah, I haven't really watched anything else, though. I've just been cracking on with what we're watching here. And I went to see Strays last night at a cinema that was full of hot dogs. Do you get it? Do you see what they've done there? They gave us all a hot dog.
Yeah.
A hot dog. Shall we get on to that, then? It's time to go walkies with this.
Hi there, big dogs. I'm trying to get home.
I know which way that is.
Oh, great.
Right up my ass, you little...
Oh, no, that can't be right.
This is Will Ferrell.
I'm lost.
You're a stray man.
You can do anything you want.
This beer doesn't taste good, but I like how it's making me feel.
This is Jamie Foxx.
I recently this couch.
Best sex of my life.
And she dirty, too.
No, well, I can tell. Looks like she hasn't been washed in years.
I'll see you later, baby.
It was nice to meet you.
So this is Strays, the story of a Will Ferrell-voiced mutt called Reggie who discovers friendship with a pack of canines when his cruel owner Doug abandons him. And it's got a voice cast including Jamie Foxx, Isla Fisher and Randall Park. And it's a comedy that includes dick jokes, drugs trips, humping and plenty of swears. It is rated. Do you see what I did there?
I see what you did there too.
It's not for kids. Before we discuss whether this is a dog's dinner or the dog's bollocks, shall we listen to what director Josh Greenbaum had to say when Bradley Russell sat down with him to discuss working with animals and adopting one of the cast?
I'm starving.
How many of these should we eat?
All of them?
Give me a sec.
Whoa.
You look different.
You look different too.
How so?
Is it my human hands?
Hold up. You know, there's been such a long and varied history of
live action dog movies. Like, did you look to any like Homeward Bound or Cats and Dogs, anything like that, for inspiration before shooting?
I mean, I grew up watching Homeward Bound and Milo and Otis, and that was sort of my era. And I remember being home, you know, sick from school, and one of my go-tos on VHS was Homeward Bound. So that was certainly kind of like, I looked at those films as to what was done, what can be done. Another big inspiration in terms of technique was Babe. It's a wonderful film in and of itself, but also the technical side of it was incredible. Very sort of not overly anthropomorphized performances from the animals, which was important to me. So I looked at sort of that whole genre for inspiration, but in terms of story and storytelling, I really also thought about and looked at films like Stand By Me, and you know, there's an old film I love called Breaking Away. That story is about four friends going on a journey and kind of each growing along the way. And you know, even references like thinking about movies like 40-Year-Old Virgin and Ted were more of the sort of, and Bridesmaids were more of the space I thought about. I was like, well, that's the film I want to tell. It just happens to be that my actors are dogs, as opposed to thinking about the film as a dog movie. I was like, no, this is a comedy. It just happens to be that the actors you're watching are, you know, on all fours and covered in fur.
What was the most difficult challenge here for you, like filming with those dogs?
Everything? Is that an appropriate answer? it was challenging. I knew it would be hard going in, and it proved to be very hard. I had wonderful animal trainers. I made the choice to strive to make the entire film with real dogs, as opposed to, you know, you could have went the path of full CG the entire film, but I wanted it to feel as real and organic as possible. I think adult audiences won't go with the sort of overly anthropomorphized CG feelings the way kids might, and I didn't want it to feel cartoony at all. I wanted to feel like you were watching the dog that, you know, I've lived with a dog and had a dog my whole life. And so that was a big part of it, and made the challenge of being on set really difficult with having four dogs. Any given day was a new challenge. We needed dogs to hump things, to pretend to poop, to knock down doors, to get picked up by an eagle. You know, any given sequence had its own challenges. I would say, weirdly, the hardest thing I discovered by the end of the film was getting two dogs to walk side by side in a traditional walk and talk. You know, that's a very normal tool in a director's arsenal. Is like, all right, for blocking the scene, I just want you two to walk side by side, have a conversation. Very easy for humans. Well, dogs don't walk next to each other. And especially if one dog's a lot bigger than the other, they don't line up. They don't look at each other. So we had to come up with techniques to keep them together, and then clicks, you know, from the side to get them to look, so it seemed like they were talking to each other. And so I learned early on that that was going to be very difficult. And of course, I had that in much of my shot list and planning for the film. So I didn't abandon it. I just stuck it out, and we made it work. But that was actually surprisingly the things you know, it's the thing you aren't expecting that becomes the most difficult.
Well, you mentioned that walk and talk. I assume then, in just in terms of technicalities like blocking, like boarding, like you have to think very differently then, I guess, about the space in front of you, because these aren't 6-foot actors. They're, you know, like they're very tiny dogs, some of them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, first of all, you know, one of the first things I did with Tim Orr, our incredible DP, was just start to get a sense of what the world looks like from 6 inches off the ground. Because that is, our two lead dogs are, you know, their heads are 8 inches off the ground, 10 inches off the ground. And all of a sudden, the world looks incredibly different. And when you're working with your production designer and you're designing, if you go on a traditional movie set, there usually aren't ceilings, right? Because that, you put the lights up there and you don't see them in most shots. Well, once you put the cameras low, you see all the ceilings, and the ceilings become more interesting than the floors. And so all of that started to become part of the process of making this film and getting with my whole team. It created challenges, but it also opened up sort of creative possibilities that were very exciting to do things differently and for things to look different.
You know, I have to ask, like, who was like the biggest dog diva on set? Or sort of putting like a stray's parlance, who was a bad dog?
None of them were bad dogs. They're all good dogs. They were. They were all wonderful. I would say, I wish I could say, oh, they were all perfect. But no, I would say the Diva Award, certainly, and all the trainers would know this, goes to Benny, who is the dog who played Bug, who's Jamie Foxx's dog. And the reason I say that is because he's supposed to be the toughest dog, who's street tough, doesn't care about anything. And that dog was the most sort of sensitive. He always had to be held in between takes by his trainer. He had a little sweater on. He would get very cold. In his defense, he has short hair, but so did Hunter, the Great Dane, who never got cold. But yeah, if it was below 70 degrees, which I don't know in Celsius what that is, sorry, but as long as it was still like, if it got dropped down a little, we had to bring in a heating pad because he didn't like his paws on wet grass. So we had to dry the grass. Oh. We had to aim heating guns sometimes at him, but they couldn't touch the other dogs because the other dogs would get way too hot because it was not that cold. So Benny wins the award for biggest diva, but his performance is great. So whatever he needs for his process.
Yeah, I'm curious to know, was there like sort of an audition process for the dogs, or at least like, was there a reason you chose the sort of breeds that you did? Because there's obviously like Border Terrier, like an Australian Shepherd. It feels like there's a real sort of mix and match element to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're casting, you know, casting the dogs was absolutely a process. I think I really looked at the characters that I needed to convey. And because I knew I was using real dogs, I wanted the dogs' breeds and looks to convey the general vibe or character right away without even any dialogue. So I needed, for Reggie, I needed a sweet-looking, naive dog who kind of just resting face, looks happy and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And a Border Terrier is fantastic. And also, Border Terriers are cast a lot for mutts, to play mixed-breed mutts. Because actually, if you don't know in dog movies, I had four dogs for each of the four dogs. So there would be four Reggies and four Bugs. And so you have kind of backups who can go off and shoot a wide shot or shoot something else while you're shooting a close-up with a hero dog. So it's a whole new world of filmmaking once you get into it. But we definitely cast that. And then once you cast the breed, even within those, I would look to my animal trainers to tell me which one of these four dogs is likely the hero. Now, I would have my preference on their face and their look, but they might say, but that's the least trainable dog, or that's the dog who doesn't listen to us very well. So there was a lot of give and take of me selecting the dog that I love the look of, but knowing which dog can really give me, you know, a great performance. Because three out of those four lead dogs had no training prior. Only Maggie was a Hollywood dog. The other three didn't know sit or stay or a single command when we started the movie, which was very scary at times.
I bet. I mean, obviously, this is an R-rated comedy, and like I was watching it last week, and like I felt like a lot of it is quite close to the bone. So I don't know, was there anything that you cut that maybe would have been too far? Because like there's everything in this. There's like squirrel threesomes. There's a surprise amount of like dog genitalia. I don't know. Was it like an anything goes sort of approach to this?
Yeah, I mean, anything goes with one goal. Is it funny? Right? I'm sort of not in there. Like I think one of the traps to making an adult or you know in our country R-rated comedy is just the goal of trying to be outrageous. Well, that's not my goal. My goal is to try to be funny. And if being outrageous in the right ways is funny, then yes, there's no rules. It's like be as outrageous as you want so long as it's funny. And yes, there are absolutely moments, many moments in this film where we went out as outrageous as we could because, you know, it made me and the rest of the filmmaking team laugh. So, and now hopefully audiences.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if you excuse the pun, but like R-rated comedies felt like a little bit of a dying breed for a little bit of a time there, maybe like 10 years ago or so. Why do you think they've sort of been rejuvenated a little bit more recently? Why do you think audiences are sort of like, I don't know, like craving that at the moment?
It's a good question. I don't know exactly why. I mean, sometimes it's just reminding people of a flavor that they maybe forgot existed. Yep. So I think some of it is us on the filmmaking side of putting more out there again, which again, you know, Universal, who's like, you know, the greatest studio at doing R-rated comedies and why I felt so lucky that we found a home and a partner in them making this film. You know, they've made most of my favorite R-rated comedies and the ones, like you said, that were really popular 5-10 years ago. And now they're putting more back out in the world like this one. And you know, I love being in a theater, you know, laughing with 350 people. Like, there's nothing better than that. That sort of communal experience it's hard to replicate it. It's a lot of my favorite memories from my childhood. And so I'm really excited that they're coming back. I thought maybe my first film might help a little bit, even though it's not necessarily R-rated, but just bring silly and comedies back. Barb and Star go to Still Amar. But a global pandemic came and said, nope, not yet. So hopefully this one can be one of many that can help usher, you know, comedies back into theaters and we can have that experience again.
Now, I think I'm right in saying you adopted one of the dogs that played Reggie. That must be like the ultimate memento from set, right?
It's funny. I just was thinking, saying that it's like I had such a wonderful experience making this film. And now I have like you said, the ultimate memento from set, you know, because you do as a filmmaker, you often like you look at set design. And you go like, what do you want to take home? Do you want to take home this sign or this little piece of set design? And I brought home a adorable, you know, puppy. To my wife and my daughters, to their delight. And I now have Will Ferrell running around in my house and running through my living room at all times. But yeah, he's the best.
I mean, you have such a like stellar cast in it, Will Ferrell, Jamie Foxx. Like, how did you sort of sell the idea to them? Because like, it is a very out there premise. Like, I can imagine when you're sort of standing across from someone like Jamie Foxx, it can maybe suddenly be very easy to suddenly get cold feet over the idea, I guess. But
Yeah, you know what's great is I think the premise of the film almost sort of, I guess, weeds out people who might not either get it or be excited, right? Yep. In a way, just the premise, you either kind of got it and were excited by the prospect of doing, taking a genre, and, you know, like the dog movie and bringing it into an adult, as an adult comedy. So it wasn't as hard a sell as you would expect. And I think Jamie and Will and Island Randall all and Will Forte, they all kind of got it right away. And I think the prospect of working together was great. Jamie Foxx and Will Ferrell had never acted in a film together. Oh, wow. Okay. So this was the first time, and I encouraged slash insisted, but they were already on board to come together for their voiceover sessions, which is not normal. So right. They were all in the room together, and Jamie and Will were in the room together improvising. And you know, it wasn't as hard as you thought. The Will Ferrell of it all, who I had a relationship with, I have to give some credit to his son, because his, at the time, maybe 12 or 13-year-old son, Axel, Will said to, he was driving the car, and he said, "Hey, Axel, would you want to watch a movie where I play kind of a foul-mouthed dog who wants to bite his owner's you-know-what off?" And his son say, like, 1,000% yes, Dad. Go make that movie immediately. So a lot of credit to Will's son for also helping push him over the edge. But I think he was game. All the actors seemed game right away when we reached out.
Well, that sounds very exciting and fun and different. And Sausage Party-esque is the impression I get about this movie, because I haven't seen it, but I know it's produced by a similar kind of writing team. So Jane, is it the dog's bollocks? Is it any good? Or is it dog's dinner?
Well, like, it's one of those ones that you really want it to be more funny than it actually is. The premise is a really straightforward one. Reggie, this very cute little wiry sort of pup, is hated by Doug, who keeps sending him places and throwing a ball and leaving him there repeatedly until he takes him 3 hours away from home and leaves him in a horrible street to fend for himself. And that's where he comes across Jamie Foxx's little dog, who's a stray, and his friends, who are played by Randall Park and Isla Fisher. And together they decide that they're going to travel back all the way that Reggie came in order to bite off Doug's dick. That's the entire premise of the film. Four dogs making their way to bite a man's dick off. So that's the level that we're dealing with. And, you know, at the screening I went to, much beer was offered and hot dogs and popcorn. The idea is that you go and see this with your mates, you have a bevy or two, and you just laugh at the dirty jokes and the, you know, the dogs eat mushrooms in the woods and have major hallucinogenic trip. There's humping jokes, there's pissing jokes. I mean, many, many bodily fluids. Dogs shagging sofas. So yeah, and so many swears that it gets to a point where it starts off being really funny, and then, you know, when it's like you get immune to it and it's no longer that funny. Is it funny, dogs swearing? Kinda, it is. But it's one of those things that is literally a one joke thing. Wouldn't it be funny if dogs were potty mouth? Here we are for 5 minutes, it is. And actually, we've made a whole movie of it. So it's a diminishing return for me. I think it's something that you'd find amusing and then it would wear off. Or, I don't know, maybe if you have had a few beverages or some magic mushrooms, it's really funny. Mm-hmm. But I found it not to be as funny as I thought it might be. Is it something you'd want to go see?
I don't know if the kind of talking rude dogs thing really does it for me initially as a joke. Like, it sounds kind of funny, but to watch 90 minutes of that, I don't know. But I am really into the idea of old school or old school feeling comedies from that. It sounds like a noughties comedy, you know, that kind of era, making it onto the big screen. I don't know. That sounds fun.
It's
like
Beethoven
idea.
And Babe gone rogue, you know, like cute dogs wreaking havoc, but with the sort of weird talking mouths of Babe.
I mean, it's produced by Lord & Miller.
It is.
Who did Spider-Verse and all that stuff. Does it have their sense of humour through it?
I would say it's not as clever as the things that they've created. If you watch the Lego movie, it works on so many levels. It's multifaceted. It's very knowing, very self-aware. This is purely, isn't it funny if a dog swears and talks about dicks, and if a dog has a huge erection in a prison? That's funny, isn't it? And so it's just really very one-dimensional and of one particular level of joke. So for me, I found that a bit disappointing, knowing what they can do and the sort of nuance that they can bring to comedy. This is sledgehammer comedy, which is absolutely fine. And if you know that going in and that's what you're prepared for, then this is probably a really fun night out with your mates.
Are the dogs, are they good actors?
Yeah, I mean, this is the other thing. It's like, is it, how much of this is CG? How much is the real dogs? You are constantly thinking about the treats that must be off screen to make them look so winsome into the camera. They are so cute. I mean, Reggie, the Will Ferrell voiced one, is particularly adorable. And he's got big, moist eyes. And Doug is such a dick to him and is so horrible. So you could go in and view this as, you know, a film about anybody who is bullied and anybody who is disenfranchised and anybody who feels put down and not valued. This is about Reggie discovering his own worth, discovering friendship, and finding that actually you do not need any of the trappings that you think you do in order to feel good about yourself. So from that point of view, you could have a philosophical trip to the cinema, but really it's about dicks, peas, and shagging.
Okay, it sounds fun. It sounds like if you had a few beers and a few hot dogs, then it would be.
How did you feel about Cocaine Bear?
I haven't seen Cocaine Bear yet, so okay. It sounds like a one joke wonder, and also it just looked a bit naff.
It's very much in a Cocaine Bear, and in fact, also some of the producers of that are involved in this. But also, I mean, if you love Will Ferrell and you love, you know, the stuff that he does, it's a bit Elf in as much as he's this little naive dog that thinks that Doug loves him and thinks that he's just playing a game of fetch and with this ball that he brings back to Doug, albeit like 300 miles away. And so there's that sort of naive fish out of water element. And Will Ferrell does do that beautifully, that sweetness and not really understanding what's going on. And also, you know, there's a lot of ad-libbing here, I'm sure. I'm sure a lot of this stuff isn't scripted and some of it's wild. But is it a Anchorman? No, it's not. So on that level, I feel like it's one of those films people will watch, enjoy, have a laugh, and then it will never trouble you ever again.
I mean, confession time. Uh-oh. I don't even like Elf as a film. The thing is, I really like Will Ferrell. I love Anchorman. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. I have no idea why Elf doesn't work for me. I love Step Brothers. You know,
Step Brothers. Catalina, why Mixer?
That it's one of the great comedies. So this, I don't know. The moment you say like it's most like Elf, I'm like, oh no.
That's putting you off.
I'll be excited to see it one day, maybe on a streaming service, which sounds probably not the most
faint praise.
I don't know. I'm not 100% sold on it. But I'm glad you had a good time. And I'm glad you got free hot dogs and beer.
I had a hot dog and a beer and a film that didn't offend me. So you know, that's a win for me on a weekday evening.
There you go. A little insight into your life.
I know that sounds incredibly tragic. Like I'm a little Reggie and maybe I need to rethink my life. But that is true. Anyway, so if you fancy Strays, Jack really doesn't. But if you do, it is out in cinemas now. Right. Shall we move on from Strays to Scarabs? It's this.
Did you know what was going to happen to my brother when you stuck him with this world-destroying thing?
It's called the Scarab.
I had no idea it would activate. It has to choose you.
So how do we get it to unchoose me?
Host acquired.
Who said that?
Systems checking. 3, 2.
It's gonna be okay.
Overreacting!
You kidnapped me!
But I hit you with that, you know?
Threat approaching. Engaging host protection.
Kick it like a judo. And when we get in mode, I'ma dog it like a Cujo.
Threat eliminated.
So this is Blue Beetle, Warner Brothers' latest superhero actioner, aimed at a family audience. Now, Jack, with all the shenanigans going on with DC and all of that, how does this fit in? And should we be spending time at the cinema watching it?
It's a really odd place for this film to be, because obviously James Gunn has taken over at DC and he's launching this new DC universe. And he said that Blue Beetle, Jaime Reyes, will be the first DCU character. But the movie itself was made under a different regime and isn't technically a DCU movie. Not that that really matters, because apart from a few references to Superman and Batman, like Batman at one point is referenced as a, he's called a fascist at one point, but that's as deep as it goes. There's no real connective tissue. This is all set in a new city. Jaime Reyes, the Blue Beetle, played by Zolo Mariadueno, and he returns home from college, and he's facing, his family are all facing the threat of eviction, of being kicked out. There are some real, like real problems going on here. So Jaime goes and works for the Cord family, and he ends up stealing a piece of technology, this scarab that turns him into the Blue Beetle. The Cord family wants it back. The villain, Susan Sarandon, is after him. The thing that makes this film different is that Jaime gets his powers in front of his family, his sister, his mother, his father, his uncle, his grandmother. They're all there and they see him transform into this superhero. So it's not like Spider-Man, where Spider-Man's hiding his identity. It's a real, this is who I am. And they're all revving him on to save the neighborhood, to do good things. And interestingly, as the movie goes on, they all get their hero moments as well. I mean, George Lopez plays the uncle. He's by far the highlight of this film. He's really funny, but he's basically the man in the chair. He does the technology stuff. And then you've got his sister, who's just quite funny and ironic. And then there's Nana, who's played by Adriana Barraza. And she gets a moment with an oversized machine gun.
Great. And so Granny and his machine gun.
It really is this kind of family film. And it tries to do something different with the superhero genre. Although it falls into a lot of trappings of being a superhero movie. I mean, even the powers that he has, he basically just has this super suit that can make items from anything. Like, it makes a massive sword that feels very Final Fantasy at one moment, and the suit talks to him, and it's got this robotic female voice, and it's very much like Tom Hardy in Venom, apart from it's nowhere near as fun.
It's nowhere near as fun.
Venom has a lot of faults, and I'm not the biggest fan of Venom, but at least there is just a really funny relationship in the middle of the film between the suit and Venom himself. You know, the kind of symbiotic, weird voice that he puts on, everything like that. Here, there's none of that. It's just a bit boring in places. I mean, it's fine. This film feels like a throwback to earlier superhero origin story. It's completely harmless. It's fun to see the family doing stuff. Susan Sarandon completely wasted, doesn't really do anything as a villain. It's fine. I think it's a lot of people will enjoy just the having a really simple superhero movie without multiverses, without characters coming in and cameoing and stuff like that. It's just a basic, easy watch. But it's fine. I think the biggest thing about it is that, you know, this is the first time a Latino actor has led a superhero film. It's the first time we've had a non-animated Latino hero kind of lead a superhero movie, especially in DC Universe. So that in and of itself is a cultural moment that will be important to a lot of people. And I think it goes back to basics and tells a superhero origin story about a kid who gets a suit and works with his family to save the day.
Yeah. But is it essential if we're gearing up for this new gun universe that we are doing? Do you think we need to have watched this? Is this homework that we need to have done?
I can't foresee it being that way. I mean, I'd say Jaime as a character just doesn't really get the development that he requires. The movie spends so much time. I mean, this is the thing that with the family dynamic, everyone getting their moment, you lose something about this central character. He's just like plucky kid who comes home from college and wants to save the day and help everyone. And that's pretty much what he is throughout the entire movie. You know, there's a bit of doubt about like, oh, should I rely on my family? But it's like, I feel like the message is quite obvious where it's like, oh yeah, we should have family help. You should. Again, that's fine. It's harmless. It's fun. I mean, if you've watched the trailer and you're not sold, then there's not much in the movie to sell you. I mean, the action is fine. It's competently done. You know, there are some hard-hitting punches in there, but there's nothing to be like, oh, you need to see this. Superman turns up or something. Do not go in expecting any of that. There's none of that connective tissue. You know, there's the odd reference here or there to those heroes, but Gal Gadot doesn't show up as Wonder Woman, although she has done in every other DC film this year.
And also the Fast and the Furious. So, you know, like, is it even a franchise if Gal Gadot hasn't literally popped up? No. Okay, so I have to say that is not making me want to rush to the cinema.
I think it's fine. I mean, maybe I'm slightly jaded by superhero movies in general.
You've got superhero fatigue.
Yeah, I think it's a very real thing. I mean, the Marvels feature in Total Film this month, plug.
Yeah, nice.
The director talks about superhero fatigue, and they're trying to do something different with that movie by making it wacky and feel different. And it doesn't feel like Blue Beetle's necessarily trying to do anything different. It's very happy playing within the genre as we know it now, which is fine. Again, you know, there's a reason all these movies were so popular to begin with, but it's not going to revolutionize it in any way. It's just a pretty basic origin story.
There you go. Faint praise then from Jack. If you fancy Blue Beetle, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right. Shall we talk amour? It's this.
Votre nom?
Andrieux. Lucas Andrieux.
Ah, c'est amusant. J'ai connu un Thomas Andrieux au lycée.
Il en a pas eu 150, hein. C'était mon père, je pense.
Vous le connaissez bien?
Comme ça.
Il faudra le dire à personne.
C'est dur de l'imaginer avec des potes.
Allez, viens.
La ferme, c'était boulot, boulot, tout le temps. Il était comment, mon père?
Qu'est-ce que tu fous, là? Je t'ai dit que ça devait rester entre nous. Tu te rends pas compte? Toi, tu vas te barrer, moi, je resterai.
Je sais que si je reste, j'en crèverai, et toi aussi.
This is Lie With Me. Who's trying to lie with who or whom? I don't know which is grammatically correct. Jack, tell us what this is about.
Well, I guess it's a double meaning because someone is lying as well.
Yes.
It's an adaptation of Philippe Besson's book of the same name, which has often been called The French Brokeback Mountain. Lie With Me follows a novelist played by Guillaume de Tonquédec. This novelist, he goes back to his small country hometown after being invited as the guest of honor to celebrate the release of a new cognac, although it's not wholly clear. It doesn't really matter. He's just there as the guest of honor for this company.
Yeah.
And while he's there, he starts reminiscing about a love affair he had as a teenager with another boy. So Stefan, the novelist, has always been open about being gay, but his lover, Thomas, who worked for a farm, was not and stayed closeted. And in fact, Thomas got married and had a child, and Stefan meets this child, who's played by Victor Belmondo, who we will definitely talk about because
just
wild,
crazy.
It really is. There are two timelines. There's the present as this novelist is going back and seeing his hometown, and then he's, as he reminisces, we get a lot of flashbacks. We get a lot of flashback sex. As he has these flashbacks, he learns a lot about himself. He learns about, you know, that time, and he talks with Thomas's son about his father, and there are revelations. I mean, it's a very slow build. I thought it was going one way, and then it did subtly kind of shift where the story was going. You know, a few surprises here and there. But the biggest thing for me was Victor Belmondo,
who is the grandson of
Jean-Paul, obviously French actor, best known for Breathless. They look exactly the same.
So the same. It's uncanny.
I thought it was like deep fake or something like that. I think it's the lips, like the pursed lips. It's identical. It's so weird. And it really takes you a moment to go, like, I hadn't really read about the film beforehand. I didn't realize they were related. I was just like, oh my God, who is this guy? Why does he look so familiar? What's going on?
Yeah, I had to sort of look him up because I was like, who is this bloke? Because I feel like I've seen him in something before, and then I realized it wasn't. It was that I'd seen his grandfather in things before, and he's just been transported from a black and white picture into this film. He's lovely in it, though. I have to say, I do think he's, you know, he's definitely inherited some of those acting genes, and a lot of the actual emotional resonance for this film does come from him for me. But I've, you know, for a film that has been sort of bandied about and compared to Call Me By Your Name, in that sort of idea of looking back on a summer that you spent with a love of your life, it didn't do it for me in terms of the central relationship between the two boys. And I think that's because, you know, no spoilers, but it does start in a very aggressive and unpleasant fashion, their sort of romance. And I found it hard to get past that, to why I would ever want to invest any time or love in a person that had treated me that way, that sort of transpires at the beginning. So I found it very difficult to warm to them as a couple and as this great love. I found it much more interesting what was happening in the present and the idea of a man who was openly gay struggling to reconcile his love for this man who hadn't come out as gay and had really sort of struggled with that identity, and how he'd sort of poured his feelings into his literature, and then how that unravels during one weekend. And there's this idea of sort of being drunk as well. They're on this cognac weekend, and he doesn't drink, but he's there on a cognac weekend, and he does sort of try a little bit of booze and stuff, and it's just horrible for him. But the idea that actually being back in that place that he hasn't been back to since he left is an intoxicant in itself, and he's drunk on memory, and that loosens him up, and that makes him think about himself and sort of reassess himself and reach out to this boy played by Belmondo. So yeah, it's a sort of film of two halves to me. One half didn't work. One half was much more successful.
I agree. I really like the present day stuff. I thought the flashbacks, they feel like they're put in there to appeal to that Call Me By Your Name feeling, and it doesn't have the same creativity that is in that film. You know, there's nothing particularly surprising about those flashbacks, but the relationship that this father and son have, and the way that impacted the son's life, and the reason for them all being in this place at the same time, that was really touching and moving and interesting and different. And I think is the selling point for the film. But it is dragged out. Like the flashbacks, they're quite long.
Yeah.
Some of them are really long, and they're silent, and they're in school, and they're looking at each other lustfully, but can't go near each other. It's fine. It's just a bit as you expect. And I wasn't in love with the location. I feel like the location was missing something. Like, it's supposed to be this French hometown. I mean, what Call Me By Your Name has going for it is it feels like a holiday.
Yes.
It feels like this incredible, you just want to go there. And I know you have been there, Jane. But this, I didn't get that feeling. Like, you know, they're riding on a motorbike. You know, one of them's on the back of the motorbike hugging the other person. I was like, oh, I know this is made to feel like I want to go on this holiday, but I don't really. It's not really doing it for me. I don't know, maybe that's like a COVID thing where they just didn't have filming locations, or it felt a bit small. I think that was missing for me. I wanted to feel like I want to be these boys on holiday, having a holiday romance, love it, you know, loving life in France. But yeah, it didn't quite do that for me.
It lacked a sort of a certain evocative nature that you got from Call Me By Your Name, where you really felt you could taste the food, the drink, you could feel the sunlight, and you could feel that absolute lust. Whereas I didn't understand what either boy saw in each other. It looked a little bit cold. And, you know, I was kind of interested in drinking a little bit of cognac that people kept swilling around in their glasses. But yeah, that sort of postcard level of escapism wasn't really there. However, if you like the idea of people exploring their past and sort of finding ways to heal, there isn't a nice element of that in the present day section. And also I really enjoyed, there's a woman in it who is a daffy sort of PR lady that seems like an absolute fool at the beginning. And halfway through, she reveals that she's not so stupid after all. She is fully aware of what's going on. And in fact, she's just juggling all these balls, and she's just looking after all these boys that are just not getting themselves organized at all. And she's basically powering this entire weekend. I liked that element as well. Would I go and see it on a big screen? Would I pay to see it? I'm not entirely sure I would. Would you?
No, I'm not sure I would either. Although, you know, if you wanted to see basically Jean-Paul Belmondo back on screen, and his grandson is very, very good. So
very
I think,
good.
You know, he's the highlight of the movie for me. I mean, now you know, now you've listened to this podcast, dear listeners, you all know that this is the case, and you won't have to Google it halfway through the movie to be like, how do I know this man? So hopefully that will help you enjoy the movie more. It's not a run to the cinema and see this one for me. Although I think with the Blue Beetle and this, they're such different films, but if I was reviewing them in the magazine, they would probably both be kind of that 3-star level for me, where it's hard to recommend doling out your cash to go to go see them now, especially when cinemas are so expensive. And there are so many great films on offer at the moment. I mean, with Barbenheimer and even Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and all these films. Although, can I just say, I did just have a thought as you were talking about a publicist. It's been a weirdly good time for publicists on screen, because there's, I mean, Orlando Bloom plays one in Gran Turismo.
Yeah.
Where quite odd that publicists having their big moment. Just, there you go.
Orlando Bloom and his weird pronunciation of the met one of the main characters' names. Yes, publicists are back. We're back with the publicists. American Sweethearts. That was the last time we had publicists really big on screen. Or maybe not. Maybe there's more. We should probably think about quite how many have been in cinema. Sweet Spell of Success, all of those. Anyway, we digress. So Lie With Me is out in cinemas on Friday. Now, we've not really had a banger this week, but if you're picking one to advise people go and see, which one is it?
Oh, man, it's a tricky one. I think maybe Lie With Me. Yeah, I know we were just saying that it wasn't the greatest, but it is an interesting film, and it's just good to support more independent and interesting movies, whereas Blue Beetle is the beginning of a new franchise that maybe probably won't be a big franchise. But I don't know about The Strays. You may recommend The Strays and think that's the one to go see.
I would say go see The Strays just because it requires zero intellectual capacity. You can see that with any of your group of friends and nobody's going to go, I don't really like French films. There's always one of those, isn't there? I have one of those. You know, everyone can sort of get it and enjoy dogs talking filthy. So I'm going to recommend Strays. I'm not going to say that you'll think about it forever and ever and it'll be on your top 10 list of the year, but for a good time on a Saturday night, it would do the job. Right. We should probably mention that there is a good time on a Friday night for this weekend if you wanted to stay in and just read a magazine, because the new issue of Total Film is out on sale. It is covered by The Marvels. They're going further, farther, faster. And there's other stuff in there. There's also, what else have you done, Jack?
I've been standing in for Matt, the deputy, and we went over, but there's a great feature in there on Cassandro. The new Libre fighting film with Gael Garcia Bernal, which sounds really great. There's a really great TF interview with Shane Meadows, which was probably the highlight for me of the new issue, just because he's such an interesting British filmmaker. And you spoke to Zendaya.
I'm sitting here waiting for you to mention that. I sat down with Zendaya and with Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor to talk about Challengers. This was when this was before the strike, obviously, and this was when Challengers was going to open the Venice Film Festival. And what a scorching opener it would have been with those three playing tennis aces who were having a sort of menage a trois, and the sort of rivalries that happen over the net and in bed. Can I just say, Zendaya, what a delightful person she is. They're all delightful. All three of them are. But that girl is an absolute just delight. I really, really enjoyed talking to her. I'd never met her before, and she was fantastic. And I just think she's just, you know, like Margot Robbie, she's one of these people that is just going places. I mean, Margot Robbie is slightly ahead of her in this, but she's produced this. She is, you know, she's a fashion icon. She is driving this entire project. She's going to be in Dune. We're going to see her next in Dune, and she'll have a much larger role in Dune 2. She just is a really interesting person to watch. And for her to have chosen to do this project and to do it with Luca Guadagnino makes it interesting in and of itself. And then to pop Josh O'Connor, who just makes really interesting choices. Obviously, he's best known for The Crown, but for other things he's done as well, God's Own Country, Be Still My Beating Heart. And then Mike Feist, who was electric in West Side Story. And then I just saw him in Brokeback Mountain on the West End. And he was so incredible in that. He's brilliant in this as well. So get the magazine to find out what they have to say about tennis camp and sex scenes and eating a lot of broccoli.
And watching Ratatouille, I hear.
And they watch Ratatouille. Isn't that wholesome of them? Isn't that lovely? What wholesome people they are. They got together and they ate loads of broccoli and watched Ratatouille.
And then acted out threesomes. And it was a great time.
Good time had by all. So yes, the new issue is on sale now. And as I say, it's got The Marvels on the cover. That is all we have time for. Do subscribe if you like this podcast and get it in your ears very easily. But before we go, we do have time for a listener's question. Right. Sweet or savoury at the cinema? Pop or plonk? What's it going to be, Jack? Do you have rules about what you can and can't eat and drink at the cinema?
I don't really have rules. I would try not to go for something too smelly. I think that would that's the main one. You know, I wouldn't have sardines or anything.
Have you been to the cinema someone cracked open a can of fish?
No, I can't say I have, but I wouldn't. I'm just saying I wouldn't do that, you know, as a sane human being. I mean, I always go for salted popcorn. I feel like you have to have popcorn at the cinema. That is a must for me. I know a lot of people are like, oh, but it makes too much noise, whatever. No, shut up. Salted popcorn is part of the experience. And then I normally go for probably some, like something chocolate to go with it, like chocolate, like minstrels or something. Sophie, my
are you one of these really depraved rebels? People that dumps the chocolates in the popcorn?
Oh, no. Oh, there. What? Got to be side by side. Do people really
There's
do
monsters
that?
Out there that do that.
Each to their own, you know? and then I probably have I'd probably spend too much money at the cinema because then I'll have a massive Sprite, or if I'm in Pitch House Central or somewhere, I'll get a beer to watch the movie and have a beer. Nothing better. How about you?
Nothing. I think there should be no food or drink in the cinema because it just makes people wee and rustle. And you should just go in and you should enjoy the seventh art as it was intended and just use it in your eyes, not putting anything in your mouth. And I mean backseat of the cinema as well, if you get my meaning.
Oh, boo. Listen, most of the popcorn is gone by the time the trailers are over anyway. So,
yeah, because if you haven't eaten it, you've dropped it and kicked it over for some poor cinema attendant to have to come and sweep up with their little sweepy shovel thing. Yeah, I hate that. I hate when you're walking out of cinema and you're standing on all the sticky popcorn and spilt drinks and the stuff like just batting around on the floor that you're kicking around. I hate it. So if I had a cinema, my cinema would be purist and you'd be not allowed. You'd have a lovely bar outside and places to eat and drink, but that's where it ends. When you come through the door, you're here to worship and that's all you're going to do.
You wouldn't be able to take in something like a martini. You wouldn't serve martinis and then be able to take it into cinema. I feel like that could work for you.
Okay, maybe I'll bend the rule into drinks that you can drink silently. What I really can't bear is when someone's got to the bottom of their big sippy cup. Or they do the, is it empty? I'll rattle all the ice cubes really loudly in a quiet bit just to see if my drink's done. No, I'm afraid I dislike that. I'm going to be very strict on this in my cinema.
Fair enough.
Yeah, maybe it will be just a cinema that sells martinis. I think that's a good, should we go into business?
I think that sounds like a great idea. And I don't see why people wouldn't come. I mean, yeah. We wouldn't show children's films, though. You'd have to show like French cinema, like Lie With Me. That would be our number one film for the week.
Yeah, we're just watching Art House. And it's just martinis in every flavour, including coffee sort of martinis for the evening shows to keep you awake. And a delightful bar with beautiful food outside. And then very, very strict guards on the door stopping anyone coming in apart from with their martini.
So was seeing the Strays like hell on earth for you if there's hot dogs and beers and drinks and everything?
No, because people had a beer that they could sip quietly. Nobody had anything with ice and a straw. That's my thing that I really, really can't bear. So, yeah, they were sipping. But there was a lot. You wouldn't have liked it because obviously the hot dogs came with onions and ketchup and everything. So that was wafting around. So for somebody not wanting the smells, that wasn't great.
That is too smelly for me, I think. I think you could do like one or two hot dogs in the crowd, but like nachos are kind of, there's a limit there. Like I would feel self-conscious, I think, taking in nachos into a cinema, especially like they're quite noisy as well.
Yeah, they're crunchy. They're crunchy. So, yeah, I'm not having it. OK, so that draconian cinema coming soon. And in the meantime, we will let you go. And please go about your business with your big drinks and whatever else you do. Just don't do it in the cinema. And we will be back next week to discuss more films. But for now, Jack, you can say goodbye. You can say it in any style you like, perhaps in the style of a Belmondo.
Au revoir.
I think you would have said it more.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Yeah.
Au revoir.
Ta-ta.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Da-da-da-da-da. It's the one and only Deagle Double G.
Snoop Dogg. Snoop Dogg.
Da-da-da-da-da. You know I'm mobbing with the D-R-E.
Yeah. You know the West Coast is back for all you suckers.
What?
Yeah, I'm burning it up.
DPGC, you should be turning it up. CPT, LBC, yeah, we hooking back up. And when they bang this in the club, baby, you got to get up. Cause homies, thug homies, yeah, they giving it up. Low life, yo life, boy.